You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard Lopate today, although through the magic of radio, he will be here in about 40 minutes to interview a filmmaker and an actor. But right now, I have the pleasure of having Jonathan Cole here. When he was provost of Columbia University, Jonathan Cole once was having a conversation with a group of illustrious alumni when he realized that all of their questions were about the quality of undergraduate education, and not one had asked about the research and discoveries by Columbia faculty members in the previous few years. So Jonathan Cole set out to write a book about why, in his words, American research universities are, quote, national treasures, the jewels in our nation's crown, and worthy of continued and expanded support. As Cole illustrates in this book, The Great American University, its rise to preeminence, its indispensable national role, why it must be protected. Everyone benefits from the achievements at American research universities. Yet the eminence of American universities is not to be taken for granted in an age where other countries are vying for technological and scientific dominance. Jonathan R. Cole served as provost and dean of faculty at Columbia University for 14 years, and he is currently a university professor there. The Great American University is published by Public Affairs, and I am very pleased that it brings Jonathan Cole to join me today to talk
about
it.
It's great to be here, Julie.
So in the book, you talk about how you, as some might say, bleed Columbia blue. You started there as an undergraduate, and you really have stayed there your whole career.
I'm just an individual who could never cut the umbilical cord, it seems. I started as an undergraduate. I got my first teaching job there. Some people say I might not be employable anywhere else, as a matter of fact. But I've been there for almost 50 years, actually, and spent 14 years, as you said, as provost and chief academic officer of the university. And now I've gone back to my love of teaching and doing research, which led to this book.
It's so interesting to think that you grew up within an institution, because for so many people, in order to make change, you have to leave and come back. But you were able to work your way through and really take on various responsibilities there.
Yes, it was. It turned out to be a career. I think that in many ways it is good for people to leave their initial university to have experiences with others and then perhaps come back to their first love. For me, I hope I, you know, could be found in the tradition of Lionel Trilling and others who stayed around Columbia for an awfully long time. In fact, their entire careers, people like Myra Shapiro, the great art historian, and who justified their utility and throw, you know, was able to thrive in that setting. I love that institution. I love New York, and it was almost impossible, really, to think about leaving.
When you began your own career there, did you have a sense of what a research institution was? I mean, what this book does is illustrate for many of us who don't know that much about it what it does. But I wondered whether that was something that was in your mind when you began.
Well, I think it's an interesting question, because I don't think I was very different from most undergraduates who felt they were there to study, to try to study with very great minds, to absorb what great minds had to say. And I was very, very lucky to have at Columbia some leaders in their fields, but I didn't really understand the extent to which they were making contributions to the advancement of knowledge, to the creation of discoveries that were changing our world, and in fact how important the university was becoming in creating the world in which I lived. I was, in that sense, a typical undergraduate who had the typical experience of having wonderful teachers, but not fully recognizing the role that they were playing in transforming the world through their discoveries, inventions, devices, medical miracles that they were creating.
You say was becoming, and that's an interesting point. The American university has a long history, but was it always so seminal in terms of the kinds of technological change that go on in this country?
Yes, actually, I think most people, when they think about higher education in the United States, we tend to think of the first university in the United States. Harvard was formed in 1636, and Yale thereafter, and some of the old private institutions in the 17th and 18th century. But in fact, the research university, as we know it, is relatively young. We don't really see the beginning of America's research universities until 100 years after the Declaration of Independence was signed in 1876 with the formation of Johns Hopkins. That was the first true research university, and it changed the way universities were organized and what they were trying to do. Up until then, they were in many ways small, sleepy colleges that were determined to generate the next generation of ministers, whereas the European universities at the time were beginning to focus much more of their attention on discovery, on research, and how to breed new researchers, as well as transmitting knowledge at a very, very high level. Those universities, particularly in Germany, became the envy of some of the young Americans who were in the process of forming our great universities, people like Daniel Coit Gilman, who was the first president of Hopkins. And so what happened was we basically created our own amalgam, our own chemistry, by importing some of the major features of the German universities, essentially its focus on research, and we mixed that with the undergraduate type of education that could be found in England, particularly at places like Oxford and Cambridge. Now, in many ways, we changed that. For example, we had a system from its very beginning which didn't focus as much on the hierarchical structure as the Germans. We were much more democratic.
You mean like a professor imparting knowledge to his or her, probably his, students, and the students absorbing it, but not much going back and forth.
Yeah, I don't think American youngsters then or now sit at the feet of the great professors. They interact with them. They ask questions. They are much more viewed as co-equals in the laboratory or in classrooms than they would be, for example, in the early 20th century in Germany. And that was an important change in the model that helped to create the American model. And I should say that we think of these universities as old, but I'm trying to argue in the book that they're actually quite young, and the vitality of them is not really felt until after the Second World War. The values that were part of the university, that came to be the bedrock core of the universities, values like meritocracy, organized skepticism, where people were who claimed certain kinds of facts or truths were held up to very, very high levels of evidence. And there was a great deal of skepticism about the truth value or truth content of ideas, as well as the idea of academic freedom and free inquiry. These all became the basis for our universities. They grew out of much of what existed and was growing in American society. But it wasn't really until 1933, at least I mark 1933 as the turning point for the move towards preeminence in the American university.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Cole. He has written a book called The Great American University. It's from Public Affairs. In the book, you do note that Hitler, for all the terrible things he did, gave a boon to American universities because of so many of the great minds who fled and came to this country. And so 1933 does sound like a turning point in a number of ways.
Yes, I mean, Hitler came to power, of course, in January 1933. By April of 1933, he had purged the universities of all the Jewish professors, regardless of their distinction, regardless of their note, regardless of whether they identified basically themselves as Germans rather than Jewish, and, of course, also political dissonances as well. Now, many of these people left immediately. Many didn't leave immediately, but they found safe haven, many of the greatest, in both England and the United States. The United States was quite extraordinary because, remember, this was the Depression, and we welcomed some of the great minds of Europe through this intellectual migration. And what they did for American universities is they built upon the youthful vitality that was growing up in American universities in fields like physics and chemistry and biology and the humanities. And they gave leadership. They provided a certain kind of intellectual leadership. So we had this wonderful chemistry that was being produced between the horizontally mobile intellectual migrants from Europe with the extraordinary young, youthful Americans, many of whom, by the way, came from minority groups who were the children of immigrants themselves, making the U.S. system much, much stronger. So the catastrophe that befell Germany in the 1930s, in some horrendous way, you might say, was a blessing in disguise for the growth of the great American university.
As I read your book, one of the things that struck me, and you mentioned it before with the idea of skepticism, is the inherent paradox in a university. Here we have these great structures, almost like great corporations now. These days, they're very, very large. And yet, at the bottom, what a university needs to do is foster questioning of authority and ideas.
Yes.
How do universities do that?
Well, it's extraordinary. And in some sense, we have this wonderful paradox in this country, and it's essential for the greatness of our universities. After the Second World War, the United States government began to fund our universities to a very significant degree, especially in the sciences and engineering, with the creation of the National Science Foundation, the reorganization in 1948 of the National Institutes of Health. So here, the government was giving us all this money to do research, and we're telling them, keep your hands off if you really want great discoveries. We need the freedom to act that is independent of ideology. And that is the way great universities will grow. So we have, at our core, an essential element that says we're going to criticize the government in many ways, accepted orthodoxies, accepted values of the society. That's part of being a great university. You should tolerate that, because the consequences of the toleration is to not only produce young people who are better educated, who are better fit for high technology, knowledge-based jobs, but also for the creation of new ideas and new discoveries that will come out of the universities if they're left alone by the state.
There's a complexity, too, within a university, I would think, where this questioning has to go on not just of institutions outside the university, but within, so that as provost or even as professor, you have people questioning what you do also. Is there a way that universities work to create a space within which that kind of questioning can actually take place?
Well, I think we fight hard to do it, and we don't always succeed. The idea of a great university is to allow any idea, regardless of how radical that idea, to enter into the marketplace of ideas and to be really debated. And the value of the idea should be assessed on the basis of the evidence that is brought to bear, and the way in which you can persuade others of the value of the content of that idea. If it's not good enough, it should be discarded or rejected. Often ideas are rejected prematurely, by the way, because on the basis of the existing knowledge, it seems absolutely appropriate to reject them, only to be found later to be actually correct and right and re-enter the discourse. But it is true that in American universities, even our very best universities, there has been periods, and there are periods, where there is a kind of orthodoxy that takes over. There's what I call the herd of independent minds, the kind of groupthink that can go on, where there are politically correct ideas that are not questioned, and people, whether they're faculty members or students, fail to adequately question the basis for these ideas because they fear sanctions. They fear that their peers will reject them, they'll scorn them, they may even do worse than that. So universities are not totally unlike other institutions, and they often succumb to this kind of orthodoxy, which I wish they would do less of.
You write about a time in our political history where there was pressure from without in terms of the communists, the Red Scare, and the way that universities, some capitulated to McCarthyism, and others, like the University of Chicago, said, wait a minute, we're not going to sanction professors.
Well, it's true that periodically, as one of my teachers at Columbia, Richard Hofstadter, said when talking about anti-intellectualism in America, that anti-intellectualism rears its ugly head in our society and at universities periodically. It certainly did in the McCarthy period. Now, Robert Hutchins, one of the great leaders in the history of higher education, the president of the University of Chicago for almost 30 years, was one of the great defenders, a tremendously courageous man who went before the Broyles commissions in Chicago that were considering legislation that would outlaw the hiring of communists or fellow travelers at the University of Chicago and elsewhere. And he gave them a civics lesson in the value of open discourse, of academic freedom. And the bills were killed very, very shortly. Now, in the last 8 years, I think before the Obama administration, we have had similar problems, it seems to me, with the imposition of external ideology, government ideology, on the universities that threaten the core values of those universities. A lot of this came after the 9/11 catastrophe in New York and the tragedy in New York and at the Pentagon. But the legislation that followed, the USA Patriot Act, for example, the Bioterrorism Defense Act, had within it certain kinds of constraints on university research that made immunological research, for example, extremely difficult. Immunological research that was designed to find cures for diseases, vaccines that even bioterrorists might like to get hold of. But the legislation, for example, prohibited a foreign student from Iran, whether or not there was any evidence, a scintilla of evidence, that that person represented a security risk, from even entering the laboratory of that scientist. The FBI was requiring reports of what the movements were, various kinds of toxins and select agents. And this led many scientists to getting out of the business of doing this kind of very basic and fundamental research. In fact, Robert Richardson, a Nobel Prize winner at Cornell, charted this, and he said that there were something like 40 laboratories doing basic immunological research against major diseases at Cornell. And after the legislation came down, the USA Patriot Act and its restrictions on certain kinds of research, it wound up that 2 years later, there were only two laboratories at Cornell that were doing this research. The professors simply wouldn't tolerate that kind of set of restrictions on their research.
I'm speaking with Jonathan R. Cole about his book, The Great American University, Its Rise to Preeminence, Its Indispensable National Role, Why It Must Be Protected, published by Public Affairs. We'll be back with more after a break. I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm speaking with Jonathan R. Cole. He's the author of The Great American University, and it's from Public Affairs. You devote a lot of the book to discoveries, and it made me think back to my childhood when there was this product called Tang, which its big claim to fame was the astronauts. It was developed for the astronauts, and I think that may have been the only reason people drank it, because it tasted really terrible. But I wondered, what are the things that you see as the sort of most important discoveries that people have made at universities that have really changed our lives, the way we live our daily lives?
Well, the remarkable thing, I think, Julie, is that it's such a range of discoveries. I mean, there are very fundamental discoveries about the origins of the universe. I mean, Einsteinian ideas and physics and astrophysics. But the range is extraordinary and magnificent, I should say, from the deep to the trivial, or seemingly trivial. Let me give you a sense of what the great American universe have produced. Most people, I think, most very educated people don't think really that lasers, for example, the FM radio, magnetic resonance imaging, the global positioning system that they use in their cars, barcodes, transistors, the improved weather forecasting that we have, cures for childhood leukemia, the pap smear, methods of surveying public opinion, ideas such as congestion pricing or human capital or the self-fulfilling prophecy come out of universities.
The self-fulfilling prophecy. I love that. That came out of somebody's research.
Robert, Robert Merton at Columbia, a wonderful sociologist, happened to be my teacher, was essentially the inventor of the idea and the concept of the self-fulfilling prophecy, which has entered into American culture and our lexicon. But there were others. I mean, the algorithm for Google, the fetal monitor, the nicotine patch, antibiotics, and, you know, I could go on and on. There are thousands of them. The discoveries of recombinant DNA, which led to biotechnology industries, the electric toothbrush, Gatorade, of course. The Heimlich maneuver was discovered at Cornell. And even, I must say, Viagra, and the basis for Viagra was discovered at American University. So here's the general point. The engine of innovation and change in this country for new industries, for new ideas, for new ways of thinking, are being generated today from our great research universities. If you suffocate them, if you disinvest in them, the consequences are not only going to be for the transmission of knowledge to our students, but it is going to be to lower the rate of growth of knowledge and to the production of ideas and discoveries that are transforming our lives every day. And it has an enormous economic impact as well. For example,
you wrote about MIT, that if the all of the companies that were developed, well, you could tell me that.
Well, I mean, it's a nice story. The if you were to take the companies that were generated out of the offspring, if you will, of MIT-related companies, there are about 4,000 of them as of 2008, and they generate somewhere in the neighborhood of $230 billion in sales a year. And that is just slightly less than the gross domestic product of both Thailand and South Africa. So if you again disinvest in education, one of the consequences, perhaps even unintended consequences, will be that these kinds of new industries, new areas where Americans can compete globally very, very well, could easily be slowed down if not coming to a halt.
You write in the book about the wrestle, in a sense, between, I may not be quoting it correctly, but pure research because I have an idea and I want to follow it, and applied research of we need to figure something out.
Yes.
What happens within universities, and how is that, that I don't know whether it's competition, but that pull between one and the other?
Well, I think that it's an important attention, but in some ways it's not as real as one might think. I mean, the pursuit of fundamental knowledge for its intrinsic value is highly, highly valued at universities, and it's what generally leads to a lot of Nobel Prizes, as a matter of fact. But what's interesting about the pursuit of fundamental knowledge is that it often leads downstream to practical applications. So, for example, let's take the laser. The laser began at Columbia, again, I must say, with the work of Charles Townes, and it was called the Maser. And when they first discovered this, with his brother-in-law, by the way, who was working at Bell Labs at the time, and they did this work mostly on weekends, it was a fundamental discovery, and they said it was a fundamental discovery in search of applications. Well, we've certainly found thousands of applications for lasers in our lives today. So often these fundamental ideas lead to practical discoveries. But there is also, in fields like biology and the biomedical sciences, what we might call Pasteur's quadrant. And that is work which is both fundamental in nature, but also designed to cure diseases or to have very practical applications in vaccines that are produced and the like. So while the tension exists, they're not really incompatible.
In terms of talent, there, you write about the competition amongst these great universities for the great talent. And can you tell us about a moment in your own experience as provost where three of your top scientists were being wooed away by another university?
Yes, that's one of my early experiences as provost at Columbia. The dean of the medical school at the time came to me and said that another great institution was trying to woo three of our young and best and brightest talents. And the question was, well, what would it cost us to maintain them? And it was the price tag turned out for these three great scientists, $30 million.
And that's not just their salaries, or is it?
No, it was not their salaries at all. It was mostly laboratories, laboratory equipment, the cost of supporting postdoctoral fellows and the like. So equipment, these kinds of things.
It's like putting together a little company.
It is. They're like little communities and very, very active communities at that. And even I asked him, well, what could we get for $30 million? What would be the alternatives? He came back and we did some real work on it. And he said, these are really brilliant people. And the morale of the place would go down if we lost them. So we said, okay, we'll do it. So we committed $30 million. And the next day we had to figure out how we were going to find the $30 million, which we eventually did. Well, it turns out that those three young scientists at the time, one of them went on to win a Nobel Prize. One of them is a very distinguished member of the National, in fact, both of them, others are members of the National Academy of Sciences. And they are absolute leaders in their field. And they've spawned many other students and, it was a terrific investment, and yet it was the result of competition that led us to improve the facilities that made their laboratories work better.
Is there a downside to this competition, too? And might there be a kind of sense of frustration amongst some of the other faculty to see these sorts of things happen and think, well, what about us?
Well, there is a problem in the potential for growing inequalities within the university and a sense that there is such a star system. There isn't a question that we are living in a period of academic free agency. So that, for example, the terrible things that are going on in California with the disinvestment in higher education at the great universities there like Berkeley, UCLA, if you think the vultures from Princeton, from Harvard, from Columbia and Chicago aren't out there sort of waiting with great sympathy for the universities of California and feeling their pain, but nonetheless waiting to pick off their greatest scientists and scholars, you would be wrong. I mean, they are. There's tremendous competition in the system. Now, the competition, I think, overall has been terrific, but there can be too much of a good thing. And you can find that the competition can go so far that it becomes dysfunctional for the system. So one has to find ways in which great universities themselves can formulate more cooperative strategies. We, for example, with the New York Public Library and Princeton University, formed a consortium to store great books that we had in our libraries and do them together and serve all three institutions. And it's been a marvelous victory for all three institutions, and it's cut the costs of storage of these great, wonderful books and manuscripts for each of these institutions.
I'm speaking with Jonathan R. Cole. He has written a book called The Great American University. It's from Public Affairs. Much of your book focuses on, first, the growth of the American university and the way that research developed in the late 1800s to now. And science and technology and medicine are real focuses. What happens to the humanities when so much money and attention goes towards this kind of scientific research?
Yeah, that's an extremely important question. Now, when I was in China and I was asked to consult for a very wealthy province there, and they wanted to construct a world-class university from scratch. And when I talked to these people, they were most interested in science and engineering, and they said basically, look, we can do without the humanities. And by the way, what was your field? Your field is sociology? Oh, we can really get rid of the sociologists. they're nothing but troublemakers, so we can do away with that discipline. And I try to impress upon them that the humanities were at the essential core of the university as well as the sciences and engineering. And here is why. Not only do they have so much to say about the nature of aesthetics, the nature of values, the nature of principles of morality and ethics, all of which are very directly related to the outcomes of science and technology, and that pose immediate questions for us, value questions, which are best served by studying with philosophers, by reading extensively, by the work of the humanities. I think they have been poorly served in this nation, and I certainly hope and say in the book that I hope that President Obama and his administration realizes this and invests substantially more in the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, for example, compared to what has been done for the sciences and engineering through the NSF. I think that is extremely important for the welfare of these great institutions.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but I can imagine that it's difficult sometimes to make that argument because, you know, you quoted the figures about MIT. It's a little harder to talk about philosophy or literature and how that has a real direct economic impact, although perhaps economic impact is not the most important measure of these
things. Well, I think we have to emphasize that there is intrinsic value to the study of these subjects, and they do make us, better decision makers, wiser individuals, better citizens, all of which are very important, although this is more amorphous than telling them about a laser. So it's not as clear that the American people will get behind the support of rabbis and as opposed to actually what is produced that has a direct effect on their lives. But they should know that there is a seamlessness that is necessary between and among the disciplines, which will become even more true at the great universities in the future than it is today.
You spent pretty much your whole career kind of preparing for this book, and you told me before we began 5 years researching it. What was the most surprising thing that you learned as you put this book together that you yourself hadn't known?
Well, I think that, among the surprising things is how many challenges we face immediately political challenges and the unfortunate character of those challenges, the threats to the university. After all, I really believe that the fundamental threat does not come from abroad. It doesn't come from the Chinese or the Europeans, who, after all, if they get much better, will only force us to do much better. But it really is the problem of the threat from within. We are, to paraphrase from the cartoon character Pogo, the enemy is us. It's not others. And we have the capabilities of destroying ourselves, or at least reducing the rate at which knowledge grows and the production of great new young minds in this country. And I would hate to see that happen. And yet I see increasing evidence of those threats.
In just a minute, do you have a sense of what could be done so that that doesn't happen here?
Well, I think that the public, the reason this book was written in a way, is for the general educated public to understand these institutions better and then to get behind them, to realize how important they are and to defend them. If they are willing to defend them, they will be defended and they will thrive in the future.
This has been a labor of love and I think of scholarship. What do you see next for you? Continued teaching?
Well, I will continue to teach, and I hope to write much shorter pieces on various blogs and the like, and take up some new and very different topics and subject matters that have interested me for many years.
And it sounds like the response to this within the academic community has been...
Oh, it's been wonderful. Seven presidents from great universities have sent copies to all their trustees. I've been speaking there, and we've had a wonderful response to the book.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today. I've been speaking with Jonathan R. Cole about his book, The Great American University, Its Rise to Preeminence, Its Indispensable National Role, Why It Must Be Protected, and it's published by Public Affairs. Thank you. Where do you go next? Do you speak someplace nearby?
I'll be going to Berkeley to speak next.
That should be a very interesting place to speak about all of these issues.
It's great to be here.
Thank you.